guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
I'm Redbeard, and today you're in the studio for the first three seminal albums by the band.
Take a load off, Manny.
And you put the load right on.
Came out a little bit in Big Pink, almost a like a little touch of biblical, a little touch of patriotism, almost in the music, and that wasn't very fashionable at all. Hi, this is Robbie Robertson, and you're in the studio with the band.
In his best-selling autobiography, no less than the great Eric Clapton confesses to have had one musical mission after the great band Cream broke up, and that was joining America's The Band. And apparently it was no idle passing fancy, because Clapton journeyed from London to upstate New York's sleepy village of Woodstock to offer his services. At some point, it seems that Eric realized they already had a guitar player in Robbie Robertson. So Clapton returned to his Hurtwood Manor to jam with Steve Winwood and form Blind Faith instead. Watching Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz film, the band's Thanksgiving 1976 swan song, it shows how that kind of utopian lure could happen. But the earliest work on this quintet with the generic name is no less impressive. You see, when Rolling Stone magazine writers compiled their top 500 albums of all time, the band's 1968 debut, Music from Big Pink, ranked at number 34. That's almost 20 places higher than the Beatles' debut on the same list. Additionally, the band's second album that year landed at number 45 on the same list, while The Sublime Stage Fright went top 5 and sold over a million copies. Widely viewed along with Bob Dylan, The Byrds, and Graham Parsons as fathers of the Americana musical movement, the band may also have been one of rock's first alternative groups. Now, stay with me on this. In my classic rock interview with Maine songwriter Robbie Robertson, who wrote The Wait, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, Up on Cripple Creek, and The Shape I'm In, that's in the first three albums, Robbie helps make the case for this band. Here's Robbie Robertson in the studio.
The albums reflected very largely on our lives at the time, so that's what makes it a body of work, I think. Not that they were autobiographical, but that they were just a reflection of the way we felt at the time, the way we lived at the time. When we did Music from Big Pink, we were working in this pink house and up in the mountains, in the Catskill Mountains and near Woodstock, and we were living a lifestyle that was very reflective and on that album. And it was kind of family-oriented. We weren't really old enough to be that family-oriented ourselves, but as far as being close with all of our families, our parents and everything, and the style of life we lived, it was kind of almost an anti-psychedelic move we were making. Not on purpose. We weren't saying, well, everybody else is going this way, so we're going to go that way, although I guess in some way or another, we were rebelling against whatever was the flavor of the month. That's exactly what we weren't interested in, and so that was our way of rebellion. And while people were wearing psychedelic clothes and things, we were dressing in black suits and black hats, and we looked more like rabbis than we did rock stars, I think.
Just need
someplace where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said.
Still remember the first time I ever heard that song, The Wait, by The Band, from their 1968 debut, Music from Big Pink, so named for the gaudy painted house they shared in upstate New York's Woodstock. Robbie Robertson contends that it was the music's reflective quality that made Music from Big Pink so unique.
And it comes through in the music, you know, it's what appeals to you, and what you write about is, you know, what appeals to you. So that's what I mean by reflective. The making of Big Pink at that time seemed extremely experimental. Now listening to it, it seems like, well, that made perfect sense and everything. At that time, it didn't.
Fever from the band is originally on the Big Pink debut in 1968. The very beginnings of the band go back to 1959, when rockabilly veteran Ronnie Hawkins assembled a backup group billed as the Hawks. Hawkins found them one by one in the towns where he played. It was in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, that Ronnie Hawkins came across a mere kid named Robbie Robertson.
When I was 15, and this guy, Ronnie Hawkins from Arkansas, who would come up, and there was a circuit that they played up in Toronto, and, you know, they would play, you know, all the Philadelphia and New York and Toronto and Chicago and all these places. And this was just on the circuit, and whether it would be Jerry Lee Lewis or Ronnie Hawkins or Carl Perkins or Bo Diddley or whoever it was, they would come up there. And this was typical old story about the kid hanging around the outside of the nightclub and listening, you know, from outside. And there was all these bars, clubs right next door. I couldn't get into them, but I could hear the music from the outside, and I could look at these people when they would go in and come out, and I was extremely impressed. They looked better to me coming out because the sweat and it looked like this is rock and roll to me. So I was trying to find a way to swindle my way into this world. That, you know, musically, but it turned out to be like a joy musically to hear these strange combinations of tuba and fiddle and, you know, and funky drums and no bass, you know, tuba instead of bass, and Richard playing drums instead of Levon, and, you know, and mandolin instead of guitar. I mean, all of these just, you know, different approaches to it. And the whole album was done with a lot of that experimenting in mind, and it gave it a very kind of homey quality. And the songs were the thing on this record. All of a sudden, this is what separated the band from the crowd, kind of. You know, there was a whole thing going on. Everybody was over here doing this, and then over here was the band. You know what I mean? It was just like this other world, kind of music, and it was, we wanted that. It wasn't on purpose to the point that we were desperately trying to do that. It was was like, well, what's different? What's different? It was never like that. It was just like, that's interesting. Let's pursue that, you know, simple instincts.
That's Robbie Robertson, who will rejoin me next in the studio for the story of how this rock and roll stowaway would later meet the poet laureate of his generation. And then together, they would transform rock and roll at the flick of a switch.
Hi, this is Robbie Robertson, and you're in the studio with the band.
And I'm Redbeard. Starting at the tender age of only 15 in Toronto, Robbie Robertson's storybook apprenticeship with bandleader Ronnie Hawkins did have its sharp edges, however. Here's Robbie Robertson with me in the studio.
We would play all these schools, these universities throughout the South. The Hawks, everybody would, you know. One week it'd be Bo Diddley there, and the next week we'd be there, and then it'd be Conway Twitty, and, you know, then it would be Roy Orbison, and it would be all these. That's what you did. They're big yearly dances at the University of Texas and University of Arkansas and Missouri. And it was at this point, though, that I started to feel I was missing some of my growing up. I went from being 15 to being pretending I was 21 all the time. I lied about my age more than anybody else in the world, probably. I lied every day. The work in the clubs. I worked in these clubs when I was 16. You're not supposed to be there until you're 21. So I'm not even sure my voice had changed yet, and I was saying, 21!
Virgil Caine is a name, and I served on the Danville train till Stallman's cavalry came and tore up the tracks again. In the winter of 65, we were hungry, just barely alive. By May the 10th, Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so well.
Thank you.
One of the most unique songs of the last half century of any genre, with Levon Helm singing the verses and the haunting high voices of Richard Manuel, Rick Danko, and Robbie Robertson on the choruses, the band from their second album did The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. Robbie Robertson continues his tale of the ruse, playing underage in the clubs with the Hawks.
You know, I did it for 5 years. But anyway, when I got to be about, I'd say 19, I felt a vacuum in my life, and I had been so obsessed with this music thing up to that point that I'd never come up for air and noticed. All of a sudden, I realized when I would see these kids at these dances, and I never got to go to a prom. I didn't get this education. I started this education thing. So then I became, my next obsession set in, and it was books. And I started becoming a fanatic for reading, and I just read all the time. And that's when I read all of these books of Faulkner and of Steinbeck and of Hemingway. And this is where I got this whole Americana thing that came out years later in the band music.
When I get off of this mountain, you know where I want to go. Straight down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico. To Lake Charles, Louisiana, little Bessie girl I once knew. And she told me just to come on by if there's anything that she could do. Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leak. She mends me, I don't have to speak. And she defends me a drunkard's dream if I ever did see one. Good luck had just stung me, to the racetrack I did go. She bet on one horse to win, and I bet on another to show. She tore it up and threw it in my face, just for a laugh. Now there's one thing in the whole wide world I sure would like to see. That's when that little love of mine dips a donut in my teeth. Up on Cripple Creek, and she sends me if I spring a leak. And she mends me, I don't have to speak. She defends me a drunkard's dream.
She defends me a drunkard.
on Cripple Creek is just foot tapping, finger snapping, good time and music, written by Robbie Robertson from the band's second album in 1968. The most amazing thing happened in 1965, though. Robbie Robertson got a phone call from one of the two most important names in American contemporary music then. If Elvis Presley was the voice of American rock and roll in the rock revolution, then Bob Dylan was its conscience, and it was Bob Dylan on the line.
That's when we got this call to, we would come and meet with Bob Dylan. So I went up and I met with him, and we talked about musical influences and all kinds of stuff. And then him and I went to some apartment somewhere, and we, with a couple of guitars, and we fiddled around. And he said, well, listen, would you like to play these couple of dates I'm playing? One's at the Hollywood Bowl, and one's at Forest Hills in New York. This is very big-time stuff. So I thought, the Hollywood Bowl, my God. So I said, okay, we'll try anything. Let's see what this... But this was just Levon and I played with him, because he already was working with some other musicians. So we thought, well, it's just two jobs. We'll do it just to see what it is. So we played these two jobs, and the audience booed us to death.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a rambling wrong, a hard-working rambling man, and I go from town to town. Police beg your pardon, where I may go, and I ain't got no home.
Fateful decisions in rock and roll history occurred when Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm agreed to be Bob Dylan's band, taking the high-minded intellectual meaningfulness of folk music and electrifying it with the primal, pulsing anarchy and abandon of rock and roll. But Bob Dylan's largely academic coffeehouse crowd was in for a shock, and young Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm had absolutely no forewarning of what to expect. Here's Robbie Robertson with me in the studio.
I mean, it was like, I didn't understand, you know, very clearly what was going on. And it was because he was a folk singer, and this was electric music, and it was rock and roll, and all the stuff that we know now very well. So we did those things, and we thought, well, this is a very strange circumstance. And he said, listen, I'm going to do a tour of the whole country and of Europe and Australia and going everywhere. Would you and Levon like to do this? He said, no, we're part of a band. We can't do it. And that's that. We're very close about this. So he came up to Toronto. We were playing in a bar up there. And he came up and heard us. And he said, all right, let's do it with the whole band. And we did it. I mean, we played everywhere, and they booed us everywhere. And it was like such a strange way to make a buck, you know, just to travel around the world, people booing you. You pack up, go to the next place, they boo you, and you leave. And I don't know. It was hard sometimes to just keep a stiff upper lip or something. We would listen to tapes, you know, of the concerts we did sometimes after, which have gone on to become like big bootleg things. And we'd say, this isn't so bad, you know? What's everybody making such a big fuss about this for?
That was an excerpt with the band and Bob Dylan performing the Woody Guthrie classic I Ain't Got No Home at a 1968 Guthrie tribute concert at Carnegie Hall. You might notice that the audience clearly appreciated Bob Dylan teaming with the band by 1968, but oh, what a difference 3 short years can make. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Robbie Robertson in the studio for part one of The Best of the Band.
Hi, this is Robbie Robertson, and you're in the studio with the band.
Thanks, Robbie. I'm Redbeard, and we're looking at the band's best, part one. While every rock and roller was hitching a ride to New York City, L.A., or San Francisco in 1967, the band had just the opposite idea in mind. The sleepy little town of Woodstock, New York, in upstate, looked promising, according to Robbie Robertson.
Set up in the country, you can get a place, it's very easy, nobody bothers you, you can make all the noise you want, all of these things. Try it for a while and see, and Bob's up there, and blah, blah, blah. So that's what it was. It made sense, you know, to do this, to just work on some music. It was just the closest, convenient, remote from New York City. And it was an art colony. Albert Grossman had bought a house up there. And people would come up and you'd think, geez, look at this. These writers and painters live up here. It's a beautiful little town. Way to get away from the hubbub of the city, you know, and close enough that if you need some action, you can go back in. So it had kind of the best of these two worlds, and I think the attraction was that it was an art colony, and when we first moved up there, it was just this innocent little art colony that we proceeded to destroy, I guess.
Living alone would drive me crazy. Oh, you don't know the
One of my favorites from the brilliant third album, Stage Fright, from 1970, the original mix of The Shape I'm In from The Band.
So about the time that we would have thought, well, now Rick is better, now we'll go and do a tour, I had written more songs, and we had made the decision that we would start recording a new album, because we were kind of excited about the songs. And the weather up there had gotten so it was holding us down a little bit, you know, in the country when it snows, it would get very high. So you would spend like half of the day like shoveling out cars and trying to get firewood and dealing with it. And the distraction became so much that we thought we've got to do something so we can get to the point of this music, that we can get this music on tape and not have to deal by the time everybody would get to where we were going to get together to work on the songs, rehearse or whatever, the day would be over, and it became quite frustrating. We were also not really keen on going in making albums in recording studios. I thought, why don't we go to California and we'll get a house somewhere and we'll record and we'll bring everybody and, you know, whatever we need, and we'll be kind of self-contained. And we'll make this record right in the house. We'll just get some equipment and build, you know, figure out what we got to do, baffle up some things and make it a little soundproof, and make the record like that.
Start all over again.
with bass player Rick Danko's plaintive vocal on the Robbie Robertson title song to their 1973 album. That's the band with Stage Fright. The album actually went to number 5 on the sales chart, the highest ever for the band. Robbie Robertson remembers vividly the culture shock of being transported at the age of 15 from his Canadian Native American roots to deep into Arkansas with Levon Helm and Ronnie Hawkins when they joined the Hawks in 1959. According to Robbie Robertson, the land was different, the language was different, the food, the people, even the radio.
The show called King Biscuit Hour, it comes from where Levon's hometown was. And this was Sonny Boy Williamson's radio show that was on every day at 12:15. And it was sponsored by King Biscuit Flour and Sonny Boy Meal. And they would say, what time is it? And they'd say, it's King Biscuit time. And you'd hear this harmonica. And it was like this music. And you'd go to these places and to get the you know, get a barbecue sandwich or something. And you'd hear the jukebox in this place. And you'd say, wait a minute, who is that? And they'd say, oh, that's Junior Parker. And all of a sudden you were introduced to like, oh, listen to what these guitar players are doing. You know, it was just... just a little, and then mixing with what you knew with that was like inventing the next thing of rock and roll. The very beginning of rock and roll, this was like the next stage of it musically. For me, it was like a real fortunate honor, you know, to have been around at a certain time when this whole music was born and had just begun. Very important to be there doing it professionally, you know, at that young age in Memphis and in that area in its heyday. So you could say, well, where were you during the war? I was in the front lines.
Baby, don't you do it. Don't do it. Don't you break my heart. Please don't do it. Don't you break my heart. I sacrificed to make you happy. For myself, now you wanna leave me for the love of someone else. My pride is all gone. I'm with her, I'm right or wrong. I need you, baby, girl, to keep on keeping on. And you know I tried to do my best. Well, I tried to do my best. Don't do it. Don't you break my heart. Mistake was loving you too much and letting you know. Now you got me where you want me. You won't let me go, no, no. My heart was made of glass. Well, then you surely see. Heartaches and misery, girl, you've been causing me. While I've been trying to do my best, well, I try to do my best.
Try to do my best. Don't do it.
when we first went to Woodstock, I guess in 67 or something, when we moved up there from New York City, when we were working with Bob, Albert Grossman was the one who talked us into doing that, because he just thought that it's where we could find the privacy, really, to be able to put our music together, because the idea was for us now to make a record of our own. When we went up there, it was this charming little art colony, and there was a beautiful innocence to it. It had great charm, and there was no scene, there was no nothing there, you know, except the quality of life, and a lot of people had lived there for many, many years. So when we went up there, it served our purpose that we were able to put our music together. We found this house, Big Pink, that we were able to do all of the basement tapes in, and music, you know, get the music music from Big Pink together, all of these kind of things. It all was just lovely, the way it all laid out. After the Woodstock Festival, it changed everything. It became the most famous small town in the world at that time. And here they came. And it became very, very touristy, very hippie touristy. And that was somewhat interesting for a while, but then it wore off, and it started a darkness settled in. You know, a dark cloud kind of settled over the place, and that original charm for the people that had lived there so long, and all of these artists and everything, they started feeling somewhat betrayed by what had happened to their, you know, their innocence in this place. And there was nothing that anybody could do about it. The reason they called it the Woodstock Festival was only because the band and Bob Dylan lived in Woodstock up there, and it had this, you know, somewhat of a story behind a story in it, you know, that there was a mystery, and what are they doing up there in those mountains, and it was embracing that, you know, with all good intentions and everything. Nobody, you know, meant any real harm by it, but the fact that the Woodstock Festival wasn't even in Woodstock, it was like quite a distance away, actually. But what the repercussions had on this place is, you know, it just made everything change, and the whole style, lifestyle up there, it became different, and people were just showing up at your doorstep, and that whole sense of being, you know, off the map a little bit, and in a place where you could really just concentrate on your work and your art, and not have to think about these other things, would no longer apply to the place. So it wore out for me after a while, and I felt like we needed to shuffle the deck. I thought we needed something just different and refreshing. So I just wanted something new, and I left there, and I came out to the West Coast, and then the guys all came out after that, and Bob Dylan was out living in Malibu too, and it was just a wave to the West. Go West, young man, and we did.
When it was announced that Bob Dylan and the band would play 40 dates in February 1974, it says the rock world went into overdrive. That's a quote. What exactly was the fan response?
Well, this is something that I think people had been expecting for a while, because of our past history, that we would ultimately do something together. But by this time, this was now, since when we played together and did that tour in 1966, this was now 8 years later, and people had kind of given up on it. It had fallen off the expectation map, And so when we did decide to do this, you know, it seemed like a surprise all over again, where before that it wouldn't have been a surprise at all. And just enough time had passed, and it was interesting because we were coming from a place that the last time that we had done a tour together, where we played all over not only North America, but in Australia and Europe as well, that people booed us every night that we went out and played. And in 1974, we were doing pretty much what we had done then. I mean, it wasn't night and day at all. You know, we were maybe, you know, a little bit more solid and our confidence in what we were doing, because people weren't booing every night. But in 1974, when we decided to do this, it was really interesting to see that everybody that before had said, you know, this is an outrage, this mixing folk music and electric music together, and these people should burn in hell for this. That now in 74, everybody was like, this is the real deal. This is the second coming. This is blah, blah. And it was just extraordinary that the world revolved around. We didn't do anything really different, but the world did. And they came around to this thing and not only accepted it, but looked at it like it was some kind of a revelation.
This book is as valuable if you love rock and roll as the music, and to enjoy.
I spent so much time on this with Rob Bowman, of just trying to get all the information correct once and for all, because it has been wrong in so many cases, in so many books that have been written and other CD packages that have come out and everything, that it was like, okay, once and for all, we've got to get this, you know, so it's as accurate as humanly possible. So I spent so much time going over all of these details with Rob, because I wanted it to be exactly like that. This is a musical history of the band, and you know, and if you don't have this side by side to the music, it's an incomplete journey.
It's half the story, and that's why I thank you. When these 40 dates for the band and Bob Dylan were announced for January, February 74, the fan response was 6 million requests for tickets. That's 10 times the demand for the 600,000 tickets that were available.
Well, that's reassuring.
What did you do? Well, okay. It begs the question, what did you do? Well, if you can't remember what you did, you made rock history and you changed the nature of the concert business with your response. It was brilliant. You guys came up with a lottery. And it had never been done in the concert business before. You came up with a lottery.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
Well, it was desperate.
Desperate acts, desperate men.
Yeah.
You're an honest man, Robbie. No, I've always known that. You're an honest man. Okay. By late summer 1974, this momentum carried the band across the Atlantic. Now, I know you can remember this. Tell us about who you shared the bill with at Wembley Stadium and that show in September 74 that you included on a DVD that's in this musical history box.
Yeah.
Okay, tell me about that.
Yeah, this was a really special one-off situation where it was just, and it was outdoors at Wembley Stadium, which was an extension of a lot of these other dates. We had done some huge dates, like with the Grateful Dead, and we had played at Woodstock, and we had played at the Isle of Wight. And so this was another one of these things, and it was just Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joni Mitchell, and the band. And we felt like family. I remember specifically doing this. There was something about us playing together that just seemed so organic
in a way. And it was really, a fun time as well. A little crazy, but a lot of fun. In a package like this, and putting this together, like here once and for all, this is it. This is the musical history of the band, you know, with all of these, you know, over 100 songs, and plus this DVD. It's the first time that I feel like I'm saying to the public, come on back here in the back room and let me show you a couple of things. Let me play you something that that I've never played for anybody before. It feels like that, and it's because of the nature of this musical history, it all fits and it all works, and exactly the way it's all laid in here, and the whole musical journey and everything. It's a ride that I'm very, very proud to now share with the public.
That's so cool. You said something a moment ago when you were describing an intro that Garth did at the Wembley Stadium show, and it was so vivid then. It was so vivid that it's lasted all these years. And you were describing the reason why it was so vivid. You were describing what Garth did in a nutshell. You were saying, you know, we wanted to share with the English Garth's ability to do this and that all at once, that unique ability. And I want to read back to you your quote from the book in A Musical History, your quote about Garth Hudson. Quote, he was able to combine in 20 seconds of playing 10 uniquely different influences, and you could hear them all. Now, would you please elaborate on those and give a few examples that we'd all be able to relate to on this box set?
Well, in all of the whole story of, you know, rock and roll music, or whatever you want to call it, of all the different kinds of bands that have come along, and a lot of them over the years have had, you know, some very interesting and musical keyboardists. But on that playing field, to this day, there is still nobody in the league of Garth. There's just nobody that can do and has the musical library, you know, that he carries around inside of himself, and has this ability, this improvising ability. It's just above and beyond what people in rock and roll bands know how to do. And when we first asked Garth to join the Hawks, it was almost intimidating, his advanced musicality, that he could have just as easily been playing with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra,
really,
or Miles Davis, as he could with us. I mean, he had those kind of chops, and could pull them out and at any given second. He could, you know, he could be playing the most authentic official gospel music that you've ever heard, and then, you know, and without taking a breath, we would be so deep into Gregorian chants, you wouldn't know where you were. and could make this all work in the context of the songs that I was writing, the way that he would complement the songs. But he wasn't, usually these guys, they play like a, whatever they call it, a pad or a filler or something. Garth never played filler. He didn't do filler.
I don't do filler. Homie, don't do filler.
It was all just with such musicality and sounds, and he was painting soundscapes in music long, long before anything like this even existed with keyboards. And he's a pioneer of a lot of things that were to come. And he still has that same kind of adventurous mind of just pulling stuff out of the air that didn't exist and making it exist by mixing two things together that nobody would dream of putting together.
Wow. Now, that begs the question then, Robbie, and of course the question would be best put to Garth, but since he's not here, I'm going to ask you this, and I beg you to answer as modestly and as honestly. I know you'll be honest, but as modestly as possible, it begs the question, did Garth ever tell you then, if he could have played for anybody, why did he play with you?
I think that he found a niche that was somewhere in knowing our musical adventures that we had in mind of how we wanted to grow and what we wanted to learn, and that his place in the band would not be only just to perform amazing musicianship, but also to help us further our own musical abilities too. That appealed to him. The idea that he could be responsible for just raising our musical bar to another place, as well as just him being off in his own world, that made him really feel a part of everything. And we so admired and accepted Garth for everything that he was that I think he just felt a very natural attraction to where we were going musically and us as people. I think we made him feel good and feel at home. And in the beginning, there was certain hesitations with him, and it could be just a trial situation, and we'll see where it goes. But there was no looking back for us. Once Garth was in the fold, we just felt better about everything.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released. They say every man needs protection. They say that every man must fall. Yet I swear I see my reflection somewhere so high above this wall. I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released. Now yonder stands a man in this lonely crowd, a man who swears he's not to blame. All day long I hear him shouting so loud, just crying out that he was framed. I see my light come shining
down to the east.